You, Partners in Freedom. I am joined tonight by two of our greatest and most wonderful reporters and colleagues, Audrey Fahlberg and, of course, David Drucker. Welcome, you guys.
Hey, good to see you, Jonah.
So as the editor-in-chief and co-founder of The Dispatch, I made an executive decision here. So anybody who disagrees with it out there in dispatch viewing land, it's all me, not these guys. But I made the unilateral decision that we were not going to talk about the shooting in Nashville at the top of the show. If people have questions in the Q&A, we can talk about that later. All questions are fair game in the Q&A. So, but it's also incredibly depressing. There's no better example in our media culture of something that causes people to race to win, to leap to win the race to be wrong first, more than mass shootings. And sadly and truly tragically, I'm not being dismissive, there's really nothing new to say except the culture war stuff about the transgender thing. We know that guns are very hard to get rid of. We know that there's arguments for not getting rid of guns. Those arguments will be had again. They're sort of eternal ones. And we just felt like anybody who is dying to hear our takes on to hear us talk about that have other options. So we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to go and just wallow in the rank punditry.
Love it.
Just sort of kick as a way to segue into presidential politics. Our colleague and media and camera shy friend, Nick Cattagio, had a piece today about Chris Christie and his potential to be a driving force. I mean, he wasn't exactly saying he can go all the way. At least he admitted that he couldn't argue that sober. Nick made the argument that Christie, by willing to go for the jugular and actually take Trump head on, could have a could be a forcing mechanism for a much different dynamic than a lot of people are talking about right now. So I'll start with Brother Drucker. What'd you think of that? Do you agree? And if not, why not?
Well, look, I think it's important to understand that Chris Christie did learn, I think, the biggest lesson of 2016, having gone through it himself, which is the only way to beat Trump, the only way to beat whoever the front runner is, but in particular Trump, is to go straight at him and punch him in the mouth. It may not work, right? I mean, it may be that you do it and he still wins, but it's the only way to do it. And we saw in 2016, just for a little context here, and I kind of likened it to History of the World, part one, where they're at that scene in France and the Mel Brooks character tells, you know, is playing chess with real people. And they're all saying jump queen, and pretty soon everybody's jumping queen, and all a very funny scene. And in 2016, that primary was like, beat Rubio, everybody knock out Rubio. And Chris Christie had a big hand in that, actually, in that debate in New Hampshire. And ultimately, the guy to beat was Trump, and nobody wanted to go after him. And so Chris Christie understands this fundamental rule, which is if you're going to beat Trump, who is the front runner, and is a rather strong front runner, not unbeatable, not as strong as he used to be, but a strong front runner, you got to punch him in the mouth. Republican primary voters want a fighter. And the way you prove to them you're a fighter is by fighting the biggest guy on the debate stage. And so in that way, he's very valuable. And I've talked to Governor Christie about this a number of times over the past couple of months. And, I think the conflict going on within him is, having run for president once before, he knows how difficult it is. He knows that it's no fun to lose. And, you know, the part of him that has a healthy ego or a bigger than healthy ego doesn't want to run simply to be a spoiler. He wants to run with this idea that even if it's somewhat of a long shot or even if it would surprise people, he's viable. At the same time, and he's talked about this, he loves to be in the arena. I think he mentioned this to me, but you know, he might have just made the last of his big payments to one of his kids' universities, right? So a lot of the stuff that makes private sector employment very appealing and has been lucrative for him since he left the governor's office in Trenton, he's in a position now where he can think about running again if he wants. And part of him that wants to be in the arena and loves it, I think, relishes going after Trump, particularly not only because it's a part of his personality to fight when he decides he wants to, but so far, everybody else has been hesitant to do it. And that could change once Governor Ron DeSantis is an actual candidate. I don't think it's fair to say yet how he's going to function as an actual candidate. But, you know, Jonah, you and I have talked about this. Nikki Haley likes to say she's not kicking sideways. She's only kicking, you know, Joe Biden, who, I mean, I don't know how much of an achievement that is when you're not running against him yet. But whatever. Christie looks around and is like, none of you people are willing to punch the guy in the mouth. I'll do it. And I do agree, and I read Nick's column this evening, that you don't know what's going to happen, but it could have a really interesting impact on the campaign if there's at least somebody that knows how to garner headlines in his own right, and Christie was usually pretty good at that, going after Trump and hitting him where it hurts. And given that Trump is, again, still strong, but a diminished figure from who he was 8 years ago, could be interesting.
I think one more point that's important, Amy Walter, she's at the Cook Political Report. She had this great tweet today where she basically said, you know, some of these head-to-head matchups between Trump and DeSantis really don't matter that much because, you know, once DeSantis is on the debate stage, once he actually, assuming he runs, which he looks like he's going to, once he's actually on the debate stage and he's, if he's able to actually compete with Trump, that's when voters will see for themselves whether he's, you know, capable of beating the former president. But until then, you know, a lot's unclear.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, like, it's a lot of people just aren't paying attention, right? I mean, so this is all, like, people who are really paying attention are either, it's different than in normal years because there's a group of people who are paying attention because they're just hyper Trump obsessed, either pro or con. And then there are just like normal political nerds, but still most people aren't all that dialed in. It's not so much me pushing back, but you know, this idea, let me put it this way. I would have more respect for Christie's plan if he were completely and honestly open to the idea that he may just be a spoiler. Like, let's, you know, like I've been saying for a long time now, I'm perfectly happy with any single one of these guys throwing on the suicide vest, screaming Allahu Akbar and jumping on top of Trump and just taking him out. And then we just have like a normal Republican primary. And I think if you're thinking about what a post-presidential campaign career looks like for Christie, it would probably be more lucrative and better for him if he actually just took out, if he made peace with the fact that getting into the race, the only consolation prize he may get is taking out is Trump's scalp, you know, and he would be more effective that way if he understood that. But I don't think he can say that to himself, and he certainly can't say that to the public, because I don't see how going, I mean, let me put it this way. Do either of you guys see, let's say that Christie is this really effective, devastating attack dog against Trump. Does that win him any of Trump's voters?
No.
Okay. So, like,
but if you can bruise Trump, then some of the doubts that exist about his ability to win in a general election, some of the exhaustion that's out there. Look, and I, and Jonah, I've talked to voters who have just told me point blank, I love Trump. I would vote for him again. I just think the media has been unfair to him and the Democrats are relentless. And he just can't win through no fault of his own. But because he can't win through no fault of his own, I'm now looking at other candidates, right? And I don't think we talk enough about those voters, right? We talk about the voters that thank you for your service, time to move on. We talk about the voters that actually not thank you for your service. I wish you'd moved on from the beginning and never bothered me. But there, and then of course we have the true believers, and we talk about the 25 to 35%, depending on the caucus or primary that Trump's always going to have a lock on. So we think, and I think that's a good way to look at it. But I don't think we talk enough about voters who think that Trump did nothing wrong. None of this is his fault. But yeah, you know, winning is kind of important. And after three straight elections where through no fault of his own, evil forces derailed him, maybe we just have to be pragmatic about it and pick a Republican that can win because they're not going to have it in for him the way they have it in for poor old Trump. And, you know, that's where you remind them that he's vulnerable in a primary. And all of a sudden, it's they can say to themselves in this process, hey, you know, so-and-so's a fighter. He's not so bad. And it may not be Christie that benefits ever, but it could be like that guy's a fighter and that guy's looking pretty good right now. This other guy beat up. And man, I just don't know if I want to go through all that again if the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
You sound like a dean at Stanford Law School.
I'm about to get shouted down and something like that.
Audrey, you got anything you want to throw in on this?
Well, whether or not Christie is capable of defeating Trump is a question that I'm not going to weigh in on. But something that I'm reminded of is Sarah and I reported a sweep, an edition of the sweep in the fall, kind of covering Senate debates. And something that was really interesting was the debate between John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz. And, you know, recovering from a stroke, John Fetterman did terribly. He could barely string sentences together. It was really hard to watch. Mehmet Oz did, you know, Dr. Oz did really well, but it didn't end up mattering. And so traditionally, like, debates, I mean, presidential debates are obviously different. Millions more people watch them than Senate debates. But I'm curious to hear from you guys how much you think the presidential debates actually matter in shaping the race.
Yeah, I mean, just two quick points on the Oz thing, because Fetterman is a relevant subject these days. One of the reasons why, it was very cynical, but one of the reasons why they waited so long to debate was A, because he'd had a stroke and he was... And let's just stipulate all sympathy to him. It's a terrible thing. Imagine achieving the brass ring of your career right at the moment where you have this really terrible stroke. I have nothing but sympathy for the guy and his family. He's got kids, all that. That said, he's a U.S. senator, and it is a legitimate topic to talk about. And but one of the reasons why they waited so long to have a debate is because of early voting, mm-hmm. right? They pocketed all of these pro-Fetterman things, all these pro-Fetterman votes, before they did the big reveal, like, yeesh, he's not in that great shape, which I think is, there's something deeply sort of cynical and kind of dishonest about that. Also, politics ain't beanbag. But the fact that Fetterman is now going on, I think, his seventh week in Walter Reed illustrates the fact that the people who tried to bully other people, the people in the press and then the Democratic Party tried to bully people into saying having a stroke was an illegitimate subject to address. I think I have a lot to answer for. He's basically been in under psychiatric care or medical care because of profound depression and cognitive impairment in Walter Reed longer than he's actually been in the Senate itself. And I think we can all agree that if what was it, Mark Kirk Strugger that was,
yeah,
had a much milder, you know, problem. Everyone thought that was completely fair game to talk about how he shouldn't run and all that. So it seems to me like it's one of these things that sort of like the Alvin Bragg prosecution that you, as a partisan, including partisan media, you can work yourself up into justifying something that you don't realize how you're giving the other side ammo to say, you guys bend the rules so we can too.
Right. And nobody thinks about that when they do it. They always think they're virtuous. We're bending the rules for a good reason. And somehow it won't be used against us when the other side has an opportunity. And of course, they always do. Nobody seems to have any foresight.
So on the question of presidential debates, I mean, I guess that's part of Audrey, you will, not to get all fat, middle-aged old man on you, but you will learn that there are these seasons for certain debates, certain questions in political things that come up every time. And it's like, what will the debates look like? And all these kind of things. And this one's actually much more interesting, it seems to me, than normal, because there's a really non-trivial chance that the de facto frontrunner will refuse to debate. Mm-hmm. And if Trump refuses to debate, does DeSantis debate? I don't know, right? And Trump can say he's refusing to debate because he refuses to sign the pledge. He can also just sign the pledge and lie, because that's what he did the last time in 2016. And I think it's really interesting to try and game out. Do the debate stage get harsher on Trump or milder on Trump if Trump actually isn't there to defend himself? And I don't have a great answer for that either way. David, since Audrey actually was the one who asked the question, do you have a take on it?
Well, look, you know, I think some debates matter, some don't. But I think we can look back in recent history, Republican history at the very least, and see at times how much debates mattered in the 2012 Republican presidential primary. Romney still wins that thing, but Newt Gingrich beats up on the media asking him about, you know, extramarital affairs he's had. Pious baloney will be forever imprinted on my brain. And he goes ahead and wins South Carolina, and he wins it going away. And Romney had to recover in Florida before he was able to wrap that thing up. And it was very tenuous at the time. I think the way Trump beat up on other Republicans in the debates in 2016 had a huge influence on how Republican voters viewed him. I think we look at it the wrong way, right? We look at it like, do you know details? Do you know policy? And I think Republican voters and voters generally, but, you know, in this age of fighting is the biggest value for Republican primary voters. They're just looking like, how do you carry yourself? Are you a leader? Can you beat up on the guy next to you? Because if you can beat up on the Republican next to you, then you for sure are going to be able to beat up on the media, beat up on Democrats and anybody else that I consider my mortal enemy. And so I think in some ways you could look at it and say, Trump doesn't have to debate. Maybe he'll skip it. He's got his 25 to 35%. But then if I'm DeSantis or anybody else, I'm on that debate stage and I'm saying, where's Trump? I guess he's afraid. Mm-hmm. So Trump hates to be called afraid. And even though Trump skipped a debate in Iowa in 2016 in the primary, it was only one that he skipped. By then he had established himself. But, you know, he did lose the Iowa caucuses. And before Christie dispatched of Rubio in that New Hampshire debate, Rubio had the best third place finish in the history of the Iowa caucuses, narrowly missing out beating Trump for second place, goes into New Hampshire. My sources were telling me at the time in that 10-day span that Rubio's numbers were going up 5 points a day. Mm-hmm. And he was headed to victory in New Hampshire. That would have been a double whammy for Trump until, you know, and it just wasn't meant to be or whatever. And Christie dismantled him, exposes every doubt that voters had about this, you know, sort of 40 something guy who, you know, had never really run anything. And Trump ran away with it. But I guess this is my long way of saying, Audrey, is I think we're at a period of time, a period in history where these debates can matter very much, at least in a presidential context. And maybe we'll find out, well, this is the year they didn't matter, but look, I can go back, Jonah, to ancient history when I was a little kid. And I still remember Ronald Reagan saying, there you go again. And I, you know, telling Mondale, I'm not going to use age, the youth and inexperience of my opponent for political purposes. And these things stick with people and can be very, very impactful in a presidential campaign.
All right. So let's move away from wild speculation, because it's not like we're not going to have more time to speculate about presidential races. Audrey, you got a piece coming out tomorrow about the New York House GOP. Why don't you sort of give us a little outline of it?
Sure. New York is fascinating because it is such a battleground going into 2024. You know, in a year that was otherwise pretty lackluster for...
Battleground for the House, though. We're not talking about, like, presidential. Yeah,
that could... Unless Lee Zeldin mounts a surprise run against Gillibrand, who knows. but yes, House battleground. Last cycle, you know, Republicans underperformed across the country in a political environment that was supposed to be favorable for Republicans, you know. President Biden's approval ratings were underwater, gas prices were high, inflation was soaring, and Republicans only narrowly retook the House, in large part because of New York. New York Republicans kind of rode Lee Zeldin's coattails. Zeldin ran against Hochul, who really, really struggled on the issue of crime in particular. There was this one really disastrous moment in a late October debate moment. Actually, here we go again with the debates, where, you know, Zeldin's like, why don't you care about crime? Blah, blah, blah. He starts talking about the new New York bail law. And she basically says, I don't get why that's so important to you. Like, insinuating that Zeldin just wants to lock up criminals. And that was just kind of a shocker moment for a lot of independent voters. You know, do Democrats really care about our views on crime? And so that's why they were able to flip so many seats. They flipped two seats in the Hudson Valley, two seats in Long Island. One of those was George Santos, which is an entirely different question. We can get to in a moment. But yeah, House Democrats are really out on offense pretty early in the cycle. The election isn't for another year and a half, and they've already pledged $45 million trying to retake these seats. So we're definitely going to be reporting on a lot on New York a lot this cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I got to go back and forth with Starwalt about this a while back about why places like Oregon, which admittedly is not New York, but if the trend everywhere is that the older you get and the whiter you get, the more Republican you get, it's kind of weird that New York hasn't been moving this way sooner. Because a lot of those upstate and western New York districts, they might as well be like southern Ohio, or northern Kentucky or something like that, or southern Illinois. New York State, it seems to me, is one of these great examples of how whichever party can just not be the crazy party can win, right? So Zeldin does really well by just being like, yeah, I think crime's like bad and like really high taxes are bad, and doesn't get caught up in a lot of the, in part because he's the guys at 538 made this point, it was Nate Cohn in the New York Times made this point a while ago. Any place where you thought that the election denial stuff or that the post-Dobbs abortion climate could actually affect public policy, like if you thought abortion rights could go away, or if you thought election denial could lead to a rigged election, Democrats did really well. But if those issues were off the table, like in Florida, like in Virginia, like places where they were off the table because of Republicans saying we're going to stop at a 15-week thing on abortion, they aren't worried about the election stuff, or they stopped because the state is so liberal that they knew they were never going to like ban abortion and they weren't going to give election deniers control of the state, it was actually really good for Republicans because then they got to vote on the Republican issues. It was the red wave worked where the blue wave wasn't countervailing. And it seems to me that like that puts Elise Stefanik in a really ugly, weird position because she has doubled down on becoming sort of a MAGA type rather than a New York State normal Republican. And that's a weird dynamic in for the state of New York, which is normally has among the most boring, predictable politics in the state.
It's interesting you mentioned the abortion question because state Democratic Party chairman, Jay Jacobs, I talked to him a couple weeks after the election, and he was basically like, yeah, abortion was really mattered in a lot of swing states where abortion was on the ballot, ballot initiatives. But I mean, we had a lot of conversations with women voters who were like, I know that abortion's never going to be overturned in New York. So that doesn't matter to me. I care a lot more about, the random person next to me in the subway who's pushed in front of the train, high gas prices.
Which is reasonable. You can be totally pro-choice. That's, I'm just saying if you think abortion rights aren't going to go away, why vote on abortion rights in elections that have nothing necessarily to do with abortion? So do you guys have any strong feelings one way or the other about what the hell is going on? Since we talked about Fetterman, we should do a little bit of equal time here. Is Cocaine Mitch coming back? What's going on? And is there a sub Rosa fight for his job yet, or is no one willing to do that because you don't play the Game of Thrones until you know Mitch is not out of the picture?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to do that until they know for a fact he's out of the picture. I mean, I think it probably helped, and I'm sure somebody mentioned to him, but it helped that he put out a statement in his own words in the last few days, said he's working from home, he's out of inpatient rehab or whatever he had to do, and then he's looking forward to being back. But he's been gone a while, and the McConnell world is always very close to the vest with information that they want to keep close to the vest, and as long as you're showing up for work every day, that's just fine, because it's all about strategy and policy and whatever, fundraising and politics, and that's normal to keep close to the vest. He's never been, I've been covering him 15 years. In the 15 years I've been covering him, guys, he's not one of those politicians. Like, we all know who his wife is, but the only time I've ever seen him with his wife as a part of his job is when he's campaigning for re-election in Kentucky, right? So I've traveled to Kentucky. I've followed him around the state. And by the way, she's very much a part of his campaign and very public. But you don't see them sending out the Christmas card with him. And, you know, he's got children. I mean, they're grown, and I think he's got grandchildren. You don't see those kinds of pictures and that kind of stuff from Mitch McConnell, right? So he's just very much about the job publicly, except back home in Kentucky when he's running for re-election, as far as I can tell. But when something like this happens and you're either not able to let people see you work or exist, or you're just keeping information tight because that's what you do, you know, it spawns all sorts of speculation. I think the statement in the past couple of days may tamp down on that a little bit. But obviously, if we're still having this conversation in another 3 weeks from now, it means there's going to be a lot of chattering in the Senate. Because on the one hand, senators really don't want anybody telling them what to do too much. On the other hand, they want to know somebody steering the ship and making all the tough decisions for them and absorbing all the political slings and arrows for them so that they don't have to do it.
I think it's too early for anybody looking for his coat to succeed him to publicly whip votes, but it's pretty clear that John Thune and John Cornyn are both looking to succeed him.
Yeah, so, but that, I was talking with two of our colleagues at lunch today about this. Just shows you how cool I am. And the weird thing is that Cornyn and Thune are actually pretty, I mean, they're different people, different personalities, but one gets the sense that they're both perfectly acceptable to, they would be both be perfectly acceptable in McConnell, right? They're both grown-ups. They're not part of the crazy stuff. They got, you know, one's from South Dakota, one's from Texas, and Thune is improbably attractive man. Who is the de facto, let's just say for the sake of argument that McConnell announces a retirement. Who represents the Hawley caucus other than Hawley, right? Is there somebody that is considered the leader of the outsider caucus?
Well, Rick Scott, of course.
Or do they all think they are that person?
I mean, the thing is, Jonah, I don't think there are that many of them. And then I think you have to look at outsiders too in two different categories. There are the vocal outsiders that are always itching against the establishment. And then there are the insider outsiders. They're going to vote with the outsiders, but they don't really want the outsiders to be in charge, let alone themselves, because then they'd have to make a whole bunch of tough governing decisions that they know outsiders can't make and continue to be outsiders. So there are really only, you know, there's maybe a quarter, there's less than 25% of the conference, maybe 20%.
Uh-huh.
That is really gonna itch for some sort of populist-y, you know, freedom House Freedom Caucus style leadership and governance. And then you've got, you know, people that kind of vote in that way, but they want more establishment leadership and governance because they realize that those people keep the trains running on time and allow them to vote however they want without any consequence. So I do think that in a world in which, you know, in a hypothetical world in which Mitch McConnell immediately declares victory for being the longest serving leader in the history of the Senate or whatever his record is, I think Thune is the immediate heir apparent. Thune just won re-election. So he's got 6 years not to care what people say. He almost didn't run. He
prepared
two statements and came down to the wire, chose the statement that said he was running for re-election. So, and Cornyn, I believe, is up in 26. So he's got, you know, depending on what he chooses to do, has more political considerations, more that closer. And I think, again, with senators, and this is true on both sides, they want somebody steering the ship. They want somebody taking the heat and making the tough decisions, but they want somebody that kind of lets them do what they want. And so if you're a Republican because we're talking about Republicans right now, that's going to say, I am going to lead. Here is my agenda. And we're going to do this. And you're going to have a lot of them going, no, I'm not.
Right. It's also a little counterintuitive because Texas is like a huge, I mean, no defense, no offense to South Dakota, but like Texas is just a huge, important,
yeah,
serious state, right? And it's growing and it's stealing jobs from California. And the counterintuitive part is that its politics is much Trumpier than you would think from a state that has so much serious stuff going on. And it's both Trumpier and also the part that's not Trumpy is kind of Ted Cruz-y, which is not quite Trumpy, but it's its own kind of outsider thing going on. And so you could see Cornyn, you could see a lot of really silly right wingers going after Cornyn for being too establishment and turning that into a thing in the state that make it difficult for him to run for majority leader. And whereas like in South Dakota, like having the majority leader be from South Dakota would just be friggin' awesome, right? I mean, like the entire party establishment would just say, shut up, this is great, don't ruin this for us. But
I
that's
think
just
one more thing to remember about Cornyn is that he helped lead the bipartisan gun safety bill. You know, he joined Democrats in that effort after the Uvalde shooting, because the Uvalde shooting, of course, happened in Texas. Dreadful event. But, you know, that not all Republicans joined Cornyn. And, you know, I think it was like 15 or so Senate Republicans who voted for that. So I think that that's the kind of controversial legislation that could turn some Republicans off to Cornyn as leader.
All right. What's one last thing, and then we will move to Q&A. And I see your questions in the Slack channel that Ryan is feeding me, people. So I think I've tried to answer some of them, even if I didn't use your names. But we were talking about this before we went live. You know, Audrey, you mentioned there's this story that you worked on. It's gotten some chatter about how the NRSC is going out trying to find essentially, I would say, rich dudes, but there's no need to gender this, rich people to run, because that's a way to sort of deal with the challenging fundraising environment that the Republicans find themselves in. How successful has that project been?
Well, it was Ali Mutnick in Politico who wrote this story. It's a very good one. But I think this also relates to the McConnell question, because, you know, the Senate majority or minority leader, Republican leader in the Senate, doesn't just, you know, control what comes to the floor and, you know, do press conferences and help guide the conference behind closed doors. But he or she also helps run the Senate Leadership Fund, which throws tens of millions of dollars behind Senate candidates in election years. There was a lot of, party infighting between Rick Scott over at the NRSC last cycle and Mitch McConnell, a lot of fighting over candidate quality, and, you know, a lot of frustrations from McConnell world in the Senate Leadership Fund, because from their perspective, they had to throw all this money behind candidates who should have done really, really well in the fundraising department. That includes, you know, J.D. Vance in Ohio, who really, really struggled to bring in money. He still ended up winning, but, you know, in Pennsylvania, Dr. Oz, even though he self-funded a little bit, still really struggled with the fundraise. So the Senate Leadership Fund had to throw a bunch of money behind him. And so this time around, really early in the cycle, McConnell is really trying to recruit candidates who can self-fund. That includes Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, who nearly lost the GOP nomination to Oz. Not just rich dudes, but at least one rich woman, Karen Taylor Robeson in Arizona, who ran against Carrie Lake last cycle and lost. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that story continues to develop.
One other question about before we get to the Q&A, because I did the CNN Inside Politics Sunday show, and people thought I was a little nuts for thinking that Kristen Sinema, I can't remember if they thought I was nuts on air or off air, but it doesn't really matter. I think Kristen Sinema, the whole, you know, you had me at Jell-O thing where she doesn't like having Jell-O with old dudes on the Democratic side, and she's getting a lot of heat for being independent and all that. I think that if she, if they renominate someone like Carrie Lake or Carrie Lake adjacent kind of election denier type in Arizona, and what's his name? Ruben Gallego is the Democrat. That seems to me, maybe I'm just getting high on my own supply about the problems with both parties, but it seems to me that opens up a lane in a state like Arizona, which, you know, Democrats crossed over a lot. Democrats and independents crossed over a lot for McCain. They kind of like the Maverick thing. Goldwater got a lot of liberal votes back in the day. I mean, I know Arizona's changed, but it's got this weird sort of libertarian thing going on that a lot of other states don't. I think that's the path for her to get reelected. Am I crazy on that?
No, I don't think that you're crazy. I think that Ruben Gallego is not going to mount a very strong challenge. I mean, it's early in the cycle, but, you know, he's only ever run in an ultra progressive district. He's never really had to run a super competitive race. If it is somebody like Carrie Lake, I mean, Arizona voters have made clear that they're not interested in somebody like that governing in Arizona.
Even if they have an alternative who's not a crazy left wing Democrat type, right? I mean,
and even Mitch McConnell has called Kyrsten Sinema, I think, what was it, the most effective first term senator he's ever seen in his lifetime. I know John Thune has publicly said that he was interested in courting her to be a Republican. But yeah, if Carrie Lake wins the nomination, she'll definitely have an easier time winning re-election if she decides to formally run for another term, which right. I don't think she's announced. But
no, I don't think she has either. Drucker, you want to get in on some sweet, sweet Kyrsten Sinema handicapping?
Listen, I mean, I think when you look at I don't think you're crazy, actually, when you look at a potential three-way between Lake, Sinema, and Gallego, right? Because you're going to have a lot of in swing voters and soft Republicans or Republicans who typically vote Republican but didn't vote for Carrie Lake and right. didn't vote for Trump the second time and wouldn't vote for him again. And they're going to be looking for a place to park their vote that's acceptable to them. I think Ruben Gallego, unless he moderates, triangulates in a general election, is not going to be a place they're going to be comfortable with. And of course, they'd have this dilemma, and maybe they just would leave it blank if it was a two-way. But if they can say, I don't have to vote for Gallego or Lake, I can vote for Sinema, she can end up being the receptacle of a lot of these votes, right? I think the danger for her is the Republicans don't nominate Lake. They nominate somebody who's broadly, a McCain Republican, let's say.
Right. But look, I think Doug Ducey wins it in a cakewalk if he were the nominee.
Right.
But he's not going to be the nominee.
No, but he's not going to run. Right. But no, you're not off base at all. I think, we don't know is maybe, Gallego will get smart and say to himself, listen, if I'm going to pull this off, pull votes away from Sinema, keep, people who desperately want to vote Republican but just don't like MAGA Republicans, to use the term, but to get him over to my side, I'm going to moderate a little. Maybe he'll do that. But if he doesn't, and if the Republicans don't nominate somebody acceptable, this is the best case scenario for Kyrsten Sinema.
All right. So let's just take some rapid fire questions here. I like to take one that I wanted to get to. Oh, so Michael Garrett asked, and Ryan should really let me know really soon if I shouldn't be using people's names. but you're under the bus regardless, Michael. When we were talking about New York, he asked, won't all Republican and Republican leaning voters have left New York by 2024? I get the point. A lot of New Yorkers moving to Florida. And it's a real thing, to be sure. But you got to remember that, like, one of the things that is changing the nature of the parties is that the white non-college age working class has been moving steadily into the Republican Party for a while. And that process accelerated under Trump. Not all those people can afford to move to Florida, right? And a lot of those people are tied in with, like, union jobs, or they're tied to rural agriculture jobs in New York. They can't just pick up and start over and move to Florida. And if those people who used to be the heart and soul of the FDR coalition move in significant numbers in New York State, it becomes a very different state. I just, you shouldn't shouldn't read me as saying that like it's going to happen overnight and it's going to be this massive change, but all you need is some changes at the margins to affect, you know, races and all sorts. I mean, the Elise Stefanik district, I think it was, I mean, someone correct me, but I think it was like plus 15 for Obama or something, and then like 9 for Biden. I mean, it was like it was a Democratic district for a long time.
It was a swing district at the very least. Of course, yeah. It's been redrawn, so it's now, you know, firmly Republican. One thing I'd point out about everybody moving out, Florida real estate, because of the in-migration, right, has just gone through the roof. So maybe they're going to move, but they're not all moving to Florida at this point, just for that reason. But Florida, you know, obviously, from a political standpoint, if you like the color red, Florida's doing just fine.
All right. Now, let's see. Okay. So Michael Garrett says, hearing Jonas say my name has been the highlight of my week. So thank you, Michael. Let me know. I'll record your voicemail message for you. Okay. Do you guys think there's any chance that Manchin runs for national office? Especially if what's his name, Joe Justice, this guy says Joe Judge, decides to run for the Senate.
It's something he's definitely flirted with, but Drucker, I'll kick it over to you because you reported a story on Jim Justice the other day.
I wouldn't rule it out. There's a group of big donors that Joe Manchin has contributed to him and they like him. And so I think the way this would happen is, one, Jim Justice runs for Senate. Joe Manchin concludes that Jim Justice is popular enough, and being a former Democrat rather recently, he's going to do just fine in a general election. And Joe Manchin doesn't want to go out after a distinguished career in West Virginia politics, having never lost a statewide race, at the very least, doesn't want to go out a loser, and says, I'm going to retire. And then he, you know, I don't know whether it's through these no labels or somebody decides to run an independent bid for president. So I can't rule it out. I still think it's a bit of a long shot. But Justice running for Senate's not a long shot. And the idea that Manchin would conclude with presidential turnout and a popular governor that it wasn't worth putting his consecutive win streak on the line, I mean, that's a very big possibility. Now, if for some reason Justice does not run, I think there's a good possibility that Manchin laces it up one more time.
And by the way, that question was from Anthony King. Love your work, Anthony. Krishna R. Asks, DeSantis is going to Israel. Does this help anyone? And is this a proper time? That's an interesting question. To be honest, I didn't realize he was going to Israel. I mean, I assumed eventually he was, but I didn't know that he had announced that. Drucker, you got a point of view on DeSantis?
I want to know if we can attribute this to Krishna and put it in the newsletter tomorrow. I haven't heard that yet.
Have you heard it, Audrey?
I had a headline about it. And
you're
holding out
on us.
I think that's the whole point, is that it does make for some good headlines. And maybe that's it.
By the way, if you're these days in particular, if you're a Republican, you're going to Israel, there's no downside.
Yeah.
And DeSantis is going to need to, even though he served in Congress, even though he served in the Iraq War, right? He's a veteran. It's not that he needs foreign policy bona fides like from scratch, but he needs to reacquaint himself with being a foreign policy thinker and strategist and leader. So these trips are actually going to be very important for him, especially if, you know, if the way he envisions it, he's running head to head against the former president. So one thing Trump has, aside from all the Trump stuff, is he's been commander in chief before. So that threshold is crossed, and it's going to be important for him to be at the same level with Trump.
Okay. So, I'm thinking that this is not their real name, but Magical Unicorns asks, not to be confused with Enchanted Pegasi. It's a completely different thing. Magical Unicorns asks, the mainstream media has tried to pigeonhole DeSantis as quote unquote awkward or not that charismatic. But in all the interviews I've seen, he comes across as personable and smart. What's your take on him? Audrey, do you have a take on him?
I have a friend whose dad is good friends with DeSantis. And apparently the biggest problem, it's not just how he sounds in interviews, but he's not all that interested in retail politics behind closed doors. So he's not really interested in charming donors. He doesn't care if he hurts anybody's feelings when he fires them. He's not super chatty, you know, at donor tables, that sort of thing. Whether or not that really matters is an entirely different question, because I think so much of the donor class is so fed up with Trump that they're willing to throw their money behind anybody who can take him down. But it, as for how that'll play out on the debate stage, I think is a different question.
David?
So there's going to be more on this at the Dispatch in the coming days. I just returned from Tallahassee. Thanks, boss. And I talked to a lot of people about this question, people that like him, people that don't like him, but people that know him well after 4+ years and interact with him. And it's funny, you know, when he served in Congress, he clearly was awkward and socially weird. I have to say, he always answered my questions, but he always looked like he wanted to kill me whenever I was asking him. But he didn't kill me. It was just weird. But in talking to people in Tallahassee about him, it was just what they told me was he's not actually as awkward and mean as you think he is. And when he's interested, when he wants to talk to you, if he happens to like you, he's like a really cool dude. It's just that he doesn't care. And if he doesn't like you, or if he's just doesn't feel it's necessary, he just doesn't bother. And so I think what they were trying to tell me is he can turn it on when he wants. It's just, does he want to turn it on? And the question for him in a presidential context is not so much, is he capable of retail politics? Like, can he actually do it? I get the sense, will he do it? Or will he just say, this is stupid, I've got better things to do with my time, it's enough that I showed up here and I'm only taking 5 selfies and I'm out, because I got a state to run and I got policy briefings to read and I just don't have time for this. And look, I have to say, voters in the early primary states kind of love this stuff, you know, old doddering Joe Biden, so-called. I watched him in 2020 after an hour and a half long event stay an extra 2 hours to shake every last hand and then gaggle with a couple of reporters who had to sit there for an hour and a half and wait for him to be free. But it's a really great question about DeSantis that's being asked here. And people that know him in Tallahassee seem to tell me he can do it if he wants. The question is, will he want to do it?
Yeah, so I mean, that's an interesting spin on it, and we should talk when the cameras are not rolling. I can put you in touch with a couple people who I know DeSantis well, and like I've heard everything from he's on the spectrum, which if he is, he's managing it very, very well, and like there's a lot of different things that people mean by that. So I'm not trying to use it as a pejorative thing, but that he's truly antisocial. But then I have a couple colleagues I know who were at press dinners with him off the record thing, and DeSantis turned on the charm, and you know, they went, you know, they said, I remember one friend of mine said, hey, he's not the, you know, he's not Reagan, right? But he can have a conversation, you know, I mean, he's and he can be engaging and charm you if he wants. So that sounds generally right. I think the only place I'd push back on that a little bit is, and Drucker, you actually know this a lot better than I do, but like, it's fine to say, I'm going to do 5 selfies and I'm out. Right. The question is, what is the potential for DeSantis to have a sort of like Obama, can I just finish my pancakes moment? Right. Where someone comes for the 6th selfie or the 60th selfie. And DeSantis is like, I said 5 and I'm out, and has a moment that makes him, that gets blown, you know, not necessarily Howard Dean, you know, screaming moment, but like campaigns make even charming, personable people irascible and cranky after a while. And If he's got a really, really low tolerance for it, this idea that he can just go in and declare what the parameters of his sociability are going to be sounds a little naive. You know what I mean? I mean, like,
oh, you are 100% right, by the way. And this is, I think, the could be a dilemma for his campaign, which is you can't script it perfectly and you do get irritable and tired and you're being beat up left and right every single day. And so it creates the possibility for a moment like this, because so much of what you're supposed to do as a presidential candidate, and Trump is this weird anomaly. He was a famous person and generally just did famous person events.
Right.
For everybody else, it's like I said, I watched, you know, a former two-term vice president who's like almost 80 years old spend an hour and a half. Literally, there was nobody left in line. None.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of, that's what you have to do. I mean, I've watched a lot of candidates do it, but I only use Joe Biden because he's now president. And, you know, you might think, you know, with age and irritability, but look, even he did it. And it's a problem if you won't, especially if it sparks a moment, as you just mentioned, which could happen.
Okay. So Michael Woodward asks, and I'll broaden this out to beyond just the Republican primary, but to the Hill as well, or to the House and Senate. What effect will Ukraine have on the Republican primary? So let me start with Audrey. Like, what effect? It seems to me that the loudest voices on the right that are anti-aid to Ukraine seem to be very, very online. And like the polling doesn't suggest it's nearly as a profound an issue as these people insist it is. But where do you see it shaping up as an issue for House and Senate races going into 2024? Is there as much pressure as you would, if you watch just Tucker or just follow Twitter, would you think that a sort of let Ukraine hang high and dry is a popular position among Republicans?
Well, I think you're right that the polling isn't exactly aligned with the Chip Roy caucus, but the polling has shifted a little bit and more Republicans are growing a little bit more and more skeptical to aiding Ukraine with billions and billions of dollars. That said, I think, I don't know, it's interesting, a couple things. I think foreign policy isn't as important of an issue to Republican voters as maybe we'd like to think that it is. I think voters care a lot more about other issues, namely, you know, the economy. They care a lot more about, well, they do care about China. But, you know, then there's the split over, you know, why exactly China matters, you know, and the Hawley caucus is more, you know, because, you know, they're taking American jobs, blah, blah, blah. I think another issue to think about is where is Ukraine in November of 2024? Because if the war is still going on, or if Ukraine has, God forbid, already lost, you know, that's a kind of different, entirely different question. So I'm not really sure. But
Drucker, you have a view?
You know, it's really interesting. Sometimes I wonder if this whole Republican debate about Ukraine is just because Ukraine is the one country that has an association with Donald Trump because of the, you know, phone call to Zelensky that spawned his first impeachment. And some Republicans just can't unwind Russia's invasion from Ukraine to Donald Trump's tainted association with Ukraine, right? Like, what if China had decided to invade one of its neighbors? Or what if Iran had decided to invade one of its neighbors? Here, a clearly hated country that we fear, that we talk about all the time as needing to be stopped in some form or another. And you'd think Republicans and Russia, and therefore it should be the same. But, you know, we've talked about it, why it's not for every Republican. Would Republicans be having the same internal debate about where the U.S. should exert its influence internationally? But I, you know, I think for the time being, you know, the question is, how do both, you know, how does Trump, how does DeSantis, how does Nikki Haley How do they talk about Ukraine vis-a-vis the Russian invasion, and how do they tie it to a rise in China and China threatening its neighbors in the context of a foreign policy debate? The one, and I don't think we know the answer to that yet. What I will say, Jonah, what I think is interesting is there are a lot of conservative media figures outside of Tucker Carlson and a lot of Republicans that have been supportive of Trump over the years recently that have not signed on with the populist view that Russia invading Ukraine is not a big deal and that Ukraine is somehow at fault. And even if they're not at fault, who cares, right? I mean, you know, I can look at a conservative talk show host like Mark Levin, who it took him a while in 2016, but was as Trumpy as any of them. Russia hoax, this, that, and the other, not to diminish, you know, whether or not the Russia investigation was legitimate or not, get into that. And he is beside himself, probably because of his ties to the Reagan administration and just being around for such a long time, that people are even questioning the idea that the U.S. should be helping Ukraine resist Russia. So I just, on the one hand, it can be very disconcerting as a Cold War kid to see any equivocation from the right side of the aisle when it comes to combating Russia. On the other hand, there are a lot of Trump sympathetic Republicans out there that are not signed on to this idea that it doesn't matter and we should just, you know, leave them to their own devices. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in a campaign. I don't know the answer.
That's fine. We're allowed to say that at the Dispatch.
I think one more thing that I kind of alluded to is that no, like, new Republican Senate candidates, for example, are going to want to lead with the Ukraine issue. They'd much rather lead with the China issue. And that's why you see, you know, Dave McCormick just released this new book and he talks about China for half the book. And he makes mentions of Russia and Ukraine, but in very carefully worded phrases where you can't really tell what he thinks, so that, you know, 6 months from now, he could say, well, I never blah, 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 in an interview. So the China issue is an issue that I think Republican Senate candidates in particular are much more comfortable leading on.
I think that the leaning on point is an important one, because politicians rarely want to get so far ahead of the events that if events don't go the way they think, they're left looking like schmucks. And you can be as non-interventionist, Fortress America, America First, all that kind of stuff. Like, Americans really don't like to be seen as, like, on the side of bad guys, and they really don't like being seen as bad guys. And so, like, I mean, the best example of this was Afghanistan, where the Biden administration, I think, sincerely looked at the polls. I mean, I think Biden wanted to get out for all of his other reasons. He was basically trying to win an argument that he had lost in the Obama administration. But I think he sincerely thought that the American people really wanted America to get out of Afghanistan because the polls said so. And what he didn't appreciate was, like, there's an enormous amount of social desirability bias and polling about things like that, where if you'd ask me a generic question, do you want to get out of Afghanistan? I would say, yeah. You know, who wants to be there, right? Who wants to have troops there? But the reality of how we got out, Americans are like, oh, this is embarrassing. This is shameful. We're leaving people to die. It's sort of like everyone wanted to get out of the Middle East until ISIS cut the heads off of two Americans. And then, you know, everyone's like, oh, man, you shouldn't have pulled on Superman's cape. We're going in. Public opinion can turn on a dime on this stuff. And if they start finding mass graves with kids in them, stuff like that, you don't want to be that far out there on Ukraine going the other way. And the only thing I push back a little bit, I think, David, you make a really good point about the Ukraine stuff from impeachment. But also there's the whole kind of, like, even before Ukraine, there was this very central to Trump thing about how Russia's really not bad, right?
Well, this is very true.
You know, I mean, remember those Yachts who had those T-shirts that said, I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat?
Yeah.
There was, like, that kind of thing was already going on. So, like, there's this built-in headwind about, oh, sure, Russia's the bad guy just because, you know, they're blowing up children's hospitals. Like, you know, and I think that's part of it, too.
Yeah, Putin's been such a strong man that's been appealing to that part of the populist right that likes the idea of a strong man that leads. And, you know, Putin's social conservatism, such that it is, which I'm not comparing to American social conservatives, but to the populist right, that sort of style has been, I don't know, nostalgically appealing. There's been something about it that they like.
Okay, so final question from Elhoff 601. I just kind of feel like they must have made fun of you in high school with a name like Elhoff 601. Asks, I've seen Drucker drain his glass several times this evening, but I never see him refill it. How does he do that?
Magic.
Well, there are techniques. I've learned some of these. One is to line up a bunch of glasses. So it all looks like you've just been drinking out, nursing one glass, you know. There's also a lot of the, let me fix the camera here as you pour behind the camera. But
it's a sleight of hand. I have a bottle off to the left,
My
left. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, easily, quietly, without making too much of a commotion, refilled it a little bit here and there.
No judgments, you know, from me on this, but you know,
I have the same strategy over here, but not with a less exciting drink.
Well, that's another strategy, is put gin in a water bottle.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's, what was it? In The Sting, where, Paul Newman explains you always drink gin because they can't tell that you watered it down. Anyway, we don't need to get into drinking advice. That's going to be a special paywalled, extra paywalled edition of the of Dispatch Live. Speaking of which, some very quick housekeeping. Steve, Chris Starwell, and I are going to do a live Remnant/Dispatch meetup from AI. On May 1, watch your mailboxes for details. And those of you who want to draw conclusions from the fact that Steve, Starwalt, and I all used to see each other a lot at a certain cable network, you can do that. But we're going to be talking about the state of media today. It should be fun. And I believe there will be a bar. And it will be for Dispatch community members and maybe a couple other special guest stars or something like that. So be on the lookout for that May 1 in Washington, D.C. And we've got other Dispatch meetups around the country in the works. The one I did in Denver was really just great, really wonderful bunch of people. And that's all I got. David Drucker, Audrey Fahlberg, thanks for doing this. And next week, we'll actually have a qualified host of Dispatch Live.
Thanks, Jonah.
And now we see something that goes like a Scooby-Doo ending, and people stop seeing me.